Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're pulling back the curtain on something that seems, you know, incredibly routine, almost mundane, really.
Right.
But it's actually one of the most intricate and frankly critical parts of our justice system. We're talking about the booking process in correctional facilities and, well, everything that follows an arrest.
Mm-hmm. It's way more complex than most people think.
Exactly. Think of it like a finely crafted watch. From the outside, you just see the time, simple enough.
Sure.
But underneath that face, you've got hundreds of tiny gears, springs, levers, all working in this perfect, complex synchronization. And a lot of those gears, they're completely hidden from public view, invisible really to anyone not directly involved.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
So our mission today is to take this stack of sources you've provided, articles, research notes, and really extract the most important nuggets of knowledge. We're here to give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed about these hidden gears.
And responsibilities, the legal stuff.
The deep responsibilities of officers. Yeah, the intricate legal frameworks involved. And honestly, some surprising facts you likely never even considered. We're going to make those hidden gears visible today.
And that's precisely the aim. This deep dive isn't just about listing, you know, what happens during booking and post-arrest, step A, step B.
Right, not just a checklist.
No, it's fundamentally about understanding the why behind these rigorous, often unseen procedures. Why are these protocols so critical for maintaining safety inside a facility? How do they ensure legal compliance, protecting both the integrity of the system and, crucially, the rights of the individuals going through it.
So it's the logic behind it all.
Exactly. We'll be charting a pretty comprehensive journey today, starting from the very first moments, that thorough search during booking, then moving through the vital legal safeguards, how personal property is meticulously handled, collecting all that essential data.
Hmm.
And then we'll even venture into the often overlooked stuff, like international considerations and the really precise legal timelines that govern all the post-arrest duties. It's a look that truly reveals just how much thought, detail, and interconnectedness goes into every single step.
Okay, so let's peel back that first layer of this finely crafted watch. Let's unpack its initial critical mechanism, segment one, the critical first steps, search and safety during booking.
Right.
The core question here is pretty straightforward, or seems it. Why is a thorough search so incredibly paramount right at the beginning of the booking process? It might seem obvious, but our sources, they reveal some truly surprising depths here.
Oh, absolutely. It's a truly multifaceted, and it impacts, well, everything that follows. The primary reason, the one that really resonates across all our sources, it revolves around the immediate safety of everyone involved, officers and suspects alike.
Okay, safety first. Makes sense.
Think about it. Someone's brought into this highly controlled, often pretty tense environment, like a jail, without a meticulous, systematic search. Well, they could, inadvertently, or sometimes intentionally, bring in weapons.
They're not just guns or knives, I imagine?
Not at all. That's the thing. We're not just talking obvious firearms or blades. Even seemingly innocuous items like a pen, a shoelace, maybe even a hidden piece of plastic, they can be fashioned into a makeshift weapon pretty quickly in a confined space.
Wow. Okay.
So this initial thorough search. It's a proactive measure. It's preventative, designed to mitigate harm to everyone involved, from the arresting officer, the booking officer, even to other individuals who might already be in custody.
Yeah.
It is quite literally about protecting lives from the moment someone walks through that door.
So the immediate danger is clear: weapons. But beyond that, what else are officers looking for? Is contraband just, you know, illegal drugs, or is that umbrella term much wider than most of us probably imagine?
That's a great question. Because, yeah, it is much wider. Locating and seizing contraband is another core objective, and it's about far more than just illegal drugs, so obviously that's a major concern.
Sure.
Contraband basically encompasses anything that's prohibited within the facility's secure walls. So, yes, illicit substances, but also items that could help someone escape. Think small tools, maybe lock-picking devices, even unauthorized communication devices like tiny cell phones or SIM cards.
Things that could compromise security.
Exactly. And it also includes items that could be used for self-harm, which is another really critical area we need to discuss. Finding these items during booking can actually lead to additional charges against a person.
Okay. So finding something changes their legal situation immediately.
Potentially, yes.
Right.
It significantly impacts their legal situation right from the start. So it's about maintaining the integrity and the controlled nature of this facility and just ensuring the safety of everyone inside those walls.
So a successful search isn't just about that one individual being booked. It sounds like it has this ripple effect, safeguarding the entire environment.
Absolutely. That ties directly into the third big reason: facility safety and security at a macro level.
Yeah.
Think bigger picture.
Right.
Each individual search, when it's done meticulously, contributes to the overall secure environment of the entire correctional facility, preventing the smuggling of, say, a tiny SIM card or a hidden battery might seem minor on its own, right?
Yes, sounds small.
But that device, once it's inside, could be used to coordinate outside criminal activity, plan escapes, maybe even orchestrate attacks, or cause widespread disruptions within the facility.
Okay, so it's like a domino effect.
Precisely. Every successful search is just a vital layer of protection for the whole system. It prevents potential chaos and helps ensure the facility operates in an orderly way.
Okay. Here's where, for me, this process gets particularly, well, profound and maybe a bit heart-wrenching. Our sources highlight that beyond these physical threats, there's a really deep human element at play. The responsibility to eliminate suicide risk and prevent in-custody deaths.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an incredible, almost overwhelming responsibility placed right there at the booking stage.
It truly is. And it really underscores the system's profound duty of care when someone is in custody. Our sources highlight this as absolutely critical, referencing things like the Attorney General's procedures for reporting these incidents and the explicit mandates from the Commission on Jail Standards for suicide screening.
So it's a formal screening process.
Yes, exactly. It means that during booking, every single individual goes through a deliberate, structured screening process. They're assessing their emotional and psychological stability. And this isn't just a quick glance over. It's a focused effort to identify individuals who might be at risk of self-harm.
And that information actually gets used.
Directly. The information gathered during this initial screening informs crucial decisions down the line, like where that individual is placed within the facility, what level of supervision they need, whether they need immediate psychological or medical help.
So it's proactive care.
It's a proactive measure, a direct reflection of the system's commitment, or at least its stated commitment, to an individual's well-being. It acknowledges that the booking process is deeply intertwined with immediate human welfare and mental health support. It's a stark reminder that beneath all the procedural steps, there lies this profound human responsibility.
And finally, a detail that might seem small in the grand scheme, but sounds incredibly important for accountability and maybe building a tiny bit of trust, safeguarding the prisoner's personal property. Why is that such a significant part of this initial phase?
It's absolutely fundamental. For accountability, yes, and also just to prevent disputes later on, which can be really costly and time-consuming for everyone.
Makes sense. Avoid headaches later.
Exactly. When someone's taken into custody, their personal belongings, everything from their wallet, their keys, to the clothes on their back, are meticulously cataloged and secured. This isn't just a courtesy. It ensures their property is protected while they're confined.
So there's a clear record.
A clear, undeniable record of everything they had at the time of arrest. This meticulous process helps build, well, at least a necessary level of process integrity between the individual and the staff. And critically, it significantly reduces the potential for claims of lost or stolen items down the road.
Right.
It really reinforces the integrity of the whole process, showing a commitment to proper ethical procedure, even in what might feel like a chaotic or high-stress situation.
Okay, so we've covered the why, the really critical reasons behind these initial steps. Now let's transition to the how. Our sources give incredibly specific instructions on conducting a search. It highlights that it's a disciplined method.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Methodical process, way more than just a quick pat down. It really is an art and a science, isn't it? An officer needs to be both precise and perceptive.
It absolutely is. It requires both physical technique and, just as importantly, mental composure. The jail searching procedures, detailed in our sources, they lay out these really precise core principles. First, and maybe the most human element in a high-stress situation, is a directive to keep your cool and ask for help when you need it.
Okay, that seems basic, but probably crucial.
It is crucial. It emphasizes the paramount importance of an officer maintaining composure, even when dealing with someone who's uncooperative, maybe aggressive. It's a recognition that emotional control is absolutely key in these environments. And knowing when to call for assistance, when to bring in another set of eyes or hands, that's seen as a sign of professionalism and smart safety practice, not weakness.
That's a crucial point, yeah. Emotions can escalate things so fast. What about the protocols governing, you know, who searches whom?
That's governed by strict and actually legally mandated protocol, same-sex searches. The general rule, except maybe in an absolute dire emergency, is that male officers search male prisoners and female officers search female prisoners.
And it has to be private.
Yes, and it's not just about the gender of the officer doing the searching. The search must be conducted out of view of the opposite sex. This is about respecting the individual's privacy as much as possible and minimizing the potential for accusations of impropriety later.
Okay. And the technique itself, you mentioned it's not just patting.
Right. The process itself is described with a really clear instruction. Let your hands search, eyes should observe movement. So it's not just about looking. It's about actively feeling for items. Our sources explicitly differentiate this from just a mere patting motion. They say, passing over the clothing with palm of the hand, no padding.
No padding. What's the technique then?
It specifies a crushing technique, where the fabric is actually squeezed and manipulated firmly, feeling for anything hidden underneath or, you know, sewn within the seams. It's a key distinction because a quick pat down often misses those tiny, potentially dangerous items. This methodical approach is designed specifically to reveal them.
So let's walk through the mechanics of this. How does an officer physically conduct an upper body search? It sounds incredibly systematic.
It is. It's almost like a choreographed sequence designed for maximum effectiveness. The process starts with the officer telling the individual to empty their pockets, take off any outerwear like a coat, hat, tie, also shoes and belt.
Okay, standard stuff first.
Right. But while the prisoner is removing these items, the officer's eyes are keenly observing, watching for any potential contraband being maybe discarded or any kind of deceptive movements.
Okay. Watching closely.
Very closely. After that, the systematic search of the person begins. The officer first instructs the prisoner to lower their head slightly. Then they run a comb, or maybe just their fingers, meticulously through the prisoner's hair, checking for anything hidden in the scalp or tangled in the strands.
Right, gotta check the hair.
Then they run their fingers under the collar of the shirt, firmly crushing the fabric. They proceed down each arm, feeling for items maybe attached to the arm or hidden in inner sleeves, and meticulously crushing the cuffs of the shirt.
Crushing, not patting.
Crushing, exactly. From the armpit, the hands move down both sides of the torso to the belt line. And from the collar, down the front of the prisoner, again, crushing pockets, button areas, right down to the waist. Finally, they run their hands down the entire back of the prisoner from the shoulders to the waist. Every part is covered systematically and with purpose.
Wow, that's thorough. And then the lower body, how does that methodical description continue, making sure nothing is missed down there?
Same meticulous attention to detail applies to the lower body, maintaining that systematic approach. At the belt line, the officer thoroughly checks the pants waistband, firmly crushing the fabric and running fingers through all the belt loops.
Okay.
Then, starting at the waist, they proceed down the buttocks, crushing the back pockets and methodically checking the hips down into the groin area. With both hands, they check each leg by placing their hands right where the legs and hips meet, running their hands firmly all the way into the groin area.
So really getting into all the creases and folds?
Every potential hiding spot. They meticulously crush the front pockets and the zipper area or the pants fly. The belt itself, once it's removed, isn't just set aside. It's visually inspected, flexed, tugged, twisted, checking seams for any hidden compartments or items.
Beyond the body itself, you mentioned specific items get their own detailed inspection. What are some of those, and what are officers looking for with each one?
Absolutely. No item brought in is overlooked. Shoes, for instance, aren't just glanced at from the outside. They're visually inspected, sure, but then they're flexed in several directions to expose any hidden areas. And the officer will actually strike the heel firmly on the floor.
Strike the heel? Why?
It's not just random. It's a technique specifically designed to dislodge or loosen any contraband that might be secreted away in, say, false heels or hidden within the inner sole.
Clever. Okay. What else?
Headgear or wigs are thoroughly checked. Running fingers around the crown, checking sweatbands, always being vigilant for hidden razor blades or pins. Ties are pulled taut and crushed to feel for anything hidden within the fabric or seams.
Even cigarette packs.
Even something as common as cigarette or tobacco packages. They're emptied, flattened out, and inspected inside before being returned, if allowed. Handkerchiefs are held by one corner and vigorously shaken out. Combs, other personal property, everything gets a visual inspection for anything sharp, illicit, or maybe modified in some way.
It's about leaving no stone unturned.
Pretty much. Because even the smallest item can pose a significant risk or hide something illegal. And that can have massive implications in a confined environment like a jail.
So all of these are standard procedures, sounds like. But then there's the more invasive and obviously sensitive type of search, the strip search. This is clearly a measure reserved for specific necessary circumstances, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's not routine. Our sources reference the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, specifically Rule 265. It states that strip searches are permitted when personnel reasonably believe it necessary for weapons and contraband that may pose a threat to facility security or safety.
Reasonably believe it necessary. Okay.
It's a measure reserved for situations where there's a heightened, credible concern about concealed items, things that could seriously compromise safety for everyone in the facility. Legally, these must be conducted by staff of the same gender as the individual being searched. That's non-negotiable.
And done respectfully.
And importantly, yes. They must be conducted in a reasonable and dignified manner and place, which means respecting the individual's privacy as much as possible given the circumstances and ensuring the procedure isn't used for harassment or intimidation.
So what does this all mean in the broader legal landscape, especially maybe concerning individuals arrested for relatively minor offenses?
Yeah.
There's a landmark Supreme Court case you mentioned, Florence, that directly addresses this, right?
Yeah.
Even in surprising circumstances.
Yes, that would be Florence v. Board of Chosen Freeholders of the County of Burlington, a pivotal 2012 Supreme Court case. And the real moment from this ruling isn't just that strip searches for minor offenses are allowed without reasonable suspicion.
Which is surprising in itself.
It is. But it's the Supreme Court's bold statement behind it, that the need for jail security can, in specific circumstances, powerfully override typical Fourth Amendment expectations of privacy. The key takeaway here, and it's a significant one, is that strip searches in jail for those who commit minor offenses do not require reasonable suspicion.
Wow. No reasonable suspicion needed.
Correct. This might seem counterintuitive to a lot of people, maybe even like a major infringement on individual liberties, but the court explicitly stated that they give significant deference, basically a lot of leeway, to the judgment of correctional officials.
Why? What's the rationale?
Their rationale, the court explained, comes down to what they call legitimate penological interests, which is basically legal speak for the incredibly challenging practical needs of running a safe and secure prison or jail.
The realities on the ground.
Exactly. They recognize the immense difficulties correctional facilities face in preventing dangerous items from getting inside. So to overcome this deference, the court said you'd need substantial evidence that demonstrates their policies are unnecessary or unjustified as a solution to jail security, which is a very high bar.
Wow. That truly raises an important question, doesn't it? It highlights this fundamental tension between an individual's right to privacy and the institutional necessity of maintaining security in a correctional environment. It seems the courts lean heavily towards prioritizing security in these specific, highly controlled settings.
Exactly. It's a very delicate balance, and the Florence ruling powerfully underscores the unique, intense challenges inherent in a custodial environment. Even seemingly minor items, as we discussed, can be weaponized or used to compromise the entire facility's security. So the court essentially grants broad discretion to jail officials based on those harsh, practical realities of managing a secure detention center.
Okay, moving on from the individual search and those privacy nuances, let's shift our focus slightly. Let's look at broader security measures within correctional facilities and also specific offenses that can actually occur once someone is already in custody. It's not just about what comes in the door, but what happens once someone is inside.
That's where things like the Penal Code come into play, specifically Section 9.53, titled Maintaining Security in Correctional Facility. This statute is crucial because it clearly defines when a correctional facility officer or employee is legally justified in using force.
Okay, the legal basis for using force.
Right. It states that force is justified when and to the degree the officer employee reasonably believes the force is necessary to maintain the security of the correctional facility, the safety or security of other persons in custody or employed, or his own safety or security.
So it sets clear boundaries.
It provides the critical legal boundaries for officers operating in what can be an incredibly challenging, unpredictable, and sometimes volatile environment. It ensures they have the necessary authority to act decisively when it's necessary to prevent harm or maintain order, while also providing a framework for accountability for their actions.
It sets the legal stage for their actions. Now, here's where it gets particularly interesting, maybe unexpected. We're talking about specific offenses that are legislated within these facilities, like the use of laser pointers. Seems like a strange thing to have a specific law for, but our sources highlight it, suggests it's more of a problem than we might think.
It is, apparently. And it's a very specific threat that warrants a specific legal response. It highlights how laws get enacted to protect public servants in particular ways. Penal Code 42.13, use of laser pointers, makes it an offense to knowingly direct a light from a laser pointer at a uniformed safety officer.
Who counts as a safety officer?
That includes a peace officer, security guard, firefighter, emergency medical service worker, or other uniformed municipal, state, or federal officer. While this starts as a Class C misdemeanor, which is the lowest level.
Pretty minor. Usually just a fine.
Usually. But the law includes significant enhancements based on the harm caused. If the conduct causes bodily injury to the officer, boom, it becomes a third-degree felony. If it causes serious bodily injury, it escalates dramatically to a first-degree felony.
Wow. Okay, so it starts minor but can get very serious very fast if someone gets hurt or even potentially hurt.
Precisely. And what's crucial to understand is that it's often what they call a stackable offense.
Meaning
if someone does this, they can be prosecuted under this specific laser pointer section in addition to any other laws their conduct might violate, maybe assault, for instance.
Ah, okay. Multiple charges for one act.
Right. The implication is significant. A seemingly playful or maybe just annoying act can have serious legal ramifications. Because even a momentary blinding or distraction from a laser pointer could incapacitate an officer, leading to dangerous situations for themselves, other inmates, maybe even the public if it happened during transport or something. It shows how lawmakers recognize these unique dangers and the need for clear protection for public safety folks.
And speaking of harassment, there's another really serious type of conduct our sources highlight. Harassment by persons in facilities or of public servants, specifically involving bodily fluids. This sounds quite egregious and frankly dangerous.
It is, and it's specifically addressed by Penal Code Section 22.11. The title is pretty clear. Harassment by persons in certain facilities. Harassment of public servant. This statute defines an offense committed with the intent to assault, harass, or alarm by causing another person to contact the blood, seminal fluid, vaginal fluid, saliva, urine, or feces of the actor, any other person, or an animal.
Ugh. Okay, so deliberately exposing someone to bodily fluids.
Deliberately exposing a public servant, yes. Which can be deeply disturbing, obviously, and carries potential health risks. This can happen under a few key circumstances according to the law. First, while someone is imprisoned or confined in a correctional or detention facility, which unfortunately isn't uncommon.
Right.
Second, it applies to individuals committed to a civil commitment facility, affecting officers, employees, or contractors of, say, the Texas Civil Commitment Office, particularly if they are lawfully doing their jobs or if the act is retaliation for their official duties.
And it also applies to public servants more broadly, not just those working inside facilities.
Yes, very importantly. Third, it applies if the actor causes another person the actor knows to be a public servant to contact the blood, seminal fluid, vaginal fluid, saliva, urine, or feces. While the public servant is lawfully discharging an official duty or in retaliation or on account of an exercise of the public servant's official power or performance of an official duty.
And the penalty for this?
This is classified as a third-degree felony. That's a serious charge, carrying significant potential penalties. The law also includes something interesting. A presumption of knowledge.
Meaning?
If the public servant is wearing a distinctive uniform or badge, the actor is legally presumed to have known they were a public servant. You can't easily claim you didn't know they were an officer, for example.
Got it.
And like the laser pointer offense, this is also stackable. It can be prosecuted under this section or other applicable laws, like assault. This statute really addresses a particularly repugnant and potentially dangerous form of harassment that can unfortunately occur in various public safety contexts. It emphasizes the legal system's commitment to protecting those who serve.
Okay, we've talked about preventative measures, specific offenses within facilities. Now, let's pivot to the extremely serious and sensitive situations, deaths and injuries that occur while someone is in custody. These incidents are, understandably, subject to really strict reporting and investigation requirements to ensure accountability and transparency, right?
Absolutely. The system has very clear, legally mandated protocols for such grave incidents. The Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 49.18, titled Death in Custody, mandates a rigorous reporting process. It's designed specifically to ensure transparency and accountability. If a person dies in a penal institution, the sheriff or the agency head is required to inform the local justice of the peace as soon as practicable.
Okay, initial notification.
Right. But the most critical part, I think, is this. If a person dies while in a peace officer's custody, and this specifically includes as a direct result of a peace officer's use of force, or if they die in a jail or correctional facility, the director of that law enforcement agency or facility must investigate the death.
An internal investigation.
Yes, they have to conduct an investigation. And following that investigation, they are required to file a detailed written report with the Attorney General of Texas. This comprehensive report is due no later than the 30th day after the death occurred, and the director must make a good faith effort to obtain all relevant facts and include them within that report.
So it's not just a quick notification. It's a full investigation, a detailed report, and then is that report public?
Yes, exactly. And the Attorney General is legally required to make that report, with the exception of any legally privileged information available to any interested person. This ensures a vital level of transparency and accountability in these very serious incidents. It allows for public oversight.
Important caveat, though.
Yeah, it's important to note that this specific statute, 49.18, doesn't apply to deaths or executions that occur in facilities operated by or under contract with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice under certain specific circumstances. Those fall under different reporting mechanisms. The definitions within the article also clarify what specifically counts as a correctional facility and in the custody of a peace officer, broadening the scope to include being under arrest or under physical control or restraint, not just being confined in a jail cell.
Okay, that covers deaths. What about injuries? Whether to the individual in custody or maybe to an officer involved, there must be specific, equally rigorous procedures for that too, right? To ensure proper care and keep a clear record.
There absolutely are, and they're designed to be immediate and thorough. For a prisoner with injury, the procedures are clear and prioritized. The immediate action is always call for medical assistance for treatment. The individual's well-being comes first.
Medical care first, then documentation.
Crucially, yes. Comprehensive documentation follows immediately. Photograph the offender and photograph the officer. This visual evidence is critical for everyone involved. If the injury occurs within a jail facility, proper reports must then be written. This could include use of force reports, if applicable, offense reports, and internal departmental memos.
Why is all that paperwork so vital?
This meticulous documentation is absolutely vital for several reasons. One, it provides legal protection for all parties involved. Two, it serves as critical evidence should there be any later claims or litigation. And three, most importantly perhaps, it ensures proper medical care was sought and provided for the injured party and creates a clear, objective record of the incident.
Another critical aspect related to health, especially in a confined environment where contact is sort of inevitable, is dealing with communicable diseases. What are the protocols if there's, say, bodily fluid contact with an officer or other staff?
That falls under Code of Criminal Procedure Article 18.22. It's aptly titled, Testing Certain Defendants or Confined Persons for Communicable Diseases. This applies specifically if someone arrested for a misdemeanor or felony causes bodily fluid contact like blood, seminal fluid, saliva, urine, etc., with an officer, magistrate, or corrections employee during the commission of the offense or during the arrest itself.
So if there's exposure during the arrest or offense?
Right. Then, under court direction, either on the court's own initiative or at the specific request of the exposed personnel, the arrested person must undergo a medical procedure or test to determine if they have a communicable disease, like HIV or hepatitis.
What if the person refuses?
If the person refuses to submit voluntarily, the court shall require it. That means compliance is legally mandated. It's not optional if the court orders it.
And what happens with the results? Are they just given directly to the exposed officer, or is there a specific protocol for handling that sensitive health information?
There's a specific protocol, yeah. It balances privacy with the need for information. The test results are given to the local health authority, like the county health department. They then formally notify the exposed personnel.
So it goes through a proper medical channel.
Exactly. Ensures the information is delivered correctly. Now, a very important legal limitation is explicitly stated in the law. The fact that a medical procedure or test was performed, or the results, cannot be used in any criminal proceeding arising out of the alleged offense.
Ah, so the test results can't be used against them in their criminal case.
Correct. This provision is designed to balance the legitimate health and safety concerns of the public safety personnel with the rights of the accused. It ensures necessary testing follows established health protocols while carefully protecting the individual's criminal case from being prejudiced by these health test results.
Okay, this takes us into a segment that might seem tedious on the surface, but sounds incredibly important for accountability, evidence, and just sheer record keeping. The detailed process of inventorying property and collecting personal data, it's all about creating this accurate, undeniable record of an individual's status when they enter custody. Almost like building a comprehensive profile from the ground up.
It absolutely is. And its meticulous nature really underpins much of the future legal process. This process is highly structured. For property inventory, the departmental form itself basically serves as the guide. It dictates all the booking questions and the entire meticulous process.
And they do it in front of the person.
Yes. A key principle that ensures transparency and helps prevent disputes later is to verbally describe the property in the presence of the prisoner. That way, there's ideally no confusion later about what they had.
And the descriptions have to be really specific.
Incredibly specific to avoid any ambiguity. For example, instead of just writing down gold watch, the instruction specifies describing it as yellow in color first, and then specifying its shape, size, any unique identifying characteristics, serial numbers if visible, any visible damage, emblems, specific design elements, even inscriptions. Every minute detail counts.
And for clothing, it's not just shirt and pants, I gather. It sounds like they want a fashion catalog description.
Uh-huh. Pretty close. Far from being generic, yeah. Clothing descriptions must include whether it's men's, women's, children's, or infants' clothing, its precise color or pattern, exact size, the maker's label, if it's visible, any laundry or cleaner's marks, the type of material, its design, like t-shirt, button-down, jeans, and its general condition, e.g., worn, new, torn.
Why such granular detail?
It's vital for accountability, for preventing claims of lost or stolen property later, and also potentially for evidence preservation. Our sources even touch on specific sensitive scenarios, like what to do if a credit card found doesn't belong to the person arrested, how to handle potentially stolen items, and the implications of custodial interrogation rules in those situations. Officers need to be aware of the custodial interrogation rules for any questions posed during inventory, if it looks like a separate crime might be involved.
Okay, Miranda rights might apply even during inventory.
Potentially, yes, if the questioning shifts towards incriminating evidence of another crime. Officers also must check for any impounded vehicles associated with the arrest that might need to be documented. Finally, after this thorough inventory is complete, the prisoner signs the form to acknowledge the accuracy of what's documented. This meticulous detail really forms the bedrock of accountability and integrity within the system. It ensures that someone's personal effects are protected while they're in custody.
Beyond property, there's an extensive amount of personal data collection that happens during booking. What kind of information are we talking about here? How does it paint that comprehensive picture of the individual?
It really does paint a picture. The list is extensive, designed to create a complete profile for identification and record keeping. It includes obvious identifiers like the individual's full legal name, plus any nicknames or aliases, which could be fake names they've used, or maybe former married or maiden names.
Okay.
Then a comprehensive set of physical descriptors: race, sex, exact age, date and place of birth, height, weight, hair and eye color, and even complexion specified with terms like light, medium, dark, pale, ruddy, or if the individual have acne.
And identifying marks.
Yes. Importantly, it includes specific details about tattoos, scars, marks, and deformities, noting exactly what and where. For example, 1-inch scar left foot or spider tat, LFT shoulder. These unique markers are crucial for positive identification down the line.
That's incredibly granular. What other biographical information is collected? Things like address, contact info.
Absolutely. The data collection continues with the individual's full residence address, including city and state, their driver's license number and the issuing state, social security number if they provide it, and the name and address of an emergency contact person.
Work info too.
Yes. They also collect information about occupation and place of employment, marital status and spouse's name, and significantly, the names of anyone arrested with them or any known associates. This broader network information can be vital for ongoing investigations or just understanding the context of the arrest.
And then there's the arrest data itself. This sounds like it goes beyond just the individual, focusing more on the circumstances of the arrest and the initial legal steps.
Correct. This segment of the data collection covers the specifics of the arrest event itself: the precise charges being filed, any associated warrant numbers, and the initial bond amount that's been set, if any. It includes the objective facts of the arrest, the exact place, date, and time it occurred.
Officer detail.
Details about the arresting officers and the booking officer, and the exact time the individual was booked into the jail facility are all recorded. Additionally, information about the complainant or any witnesses, including names, addresses, phone numbers, is collected, as this is obviously critical for the legal case moving forward.
Legal rights documentation.
Yes. It's also noted if a Miranda warning was given and if the prisoner is requested or already has an attorney, which directly impacts the admissibility of any statements made. A meticulous record of any phone calls granted and to whom is also kept, as access to calls is a fundamental right.
And checking for other warrants.
Crucially, yes. The process involves warrant checks and stolen property checks, following the agency's standard operating procedures, SOPs. This is to determine if the prisoner is wanted by other agencies or if they might possess stolen property related to this or other crimes.
How do they do that? Databases.
This is where large national and state systems like the TCIC and CIC system come into play. That stands for the Texas Crime Information Center and the National Crime Information Center. These hold vast databases for everything from wanted persons, missing persons, stolen articles, vehicles, boats, even Canadian warrants.
Wow.
And for more serious offenses, especially violent crimes, they'd also check VICAP, which is the Violent Crime Apprehension Program database run by the FBI. It helps track and link violent crimes and offenders across different jurisdictions.
So this comprehensive data collection really does paint a remarkably complete picture, not just of the individual, but their circumstances, connections, and the specifics of the event at the time of arrest. It truly sounds like a foundational step ensuring accurate record keeping and basically facilitating every future legal process.
Indeed. It really underpins everything that follows in the legal system. It ensures that authorities have all the necessary accurate information to proceed responsibly, legally, and also to safeguard against future disputes or misidentifications. It's an absolutely indispensable component of that watch's internal gears we talked about.
Okay, now we shift gears a bit to a less commonly known but highly significant aspect of post-arrest duties: international treaties and consular notification. This is where domestic law enforcement meets global diplomacy, and it often involves nuances that might surprise people.
It's fascinating stuff, actually. And what's really key here is that it's not just a polite gesture or courtesy, it's often a binding international obligation. The purpose of the Vienna Convention on Consular Notification, VCCR, and bilateral treaties is explicitly stated in the materials as to ensure a foreign national is not placed in a situation in which they cannot receive assistance from their own government.
So it's about ensuring access to their government's help.
Exactly. This isn't a courtesy that officers can just overlook if they're busy. It's a fundamental international commitment that nations have made to protect their citizens when they're abroad, ensuring their basic rights are upheld even when detained in a foreign country.
So how does that translate into what an officer actually has to do on the ground? I see there's a basic rule and a mandatory rule mentioned. This is where it's interesting, right? Because the individual's wishes aren't always the final word.
That's right. And understanding this distinction is absolutely crucial for compliance. The basic rule, which stems from Article 36 of the VCCR, states that a foreign detainee must be informed of his right to have his consulate notified. Pretty straightforward. Their decision, whether they want notification or not, must then be clearly documented.
And this applies to everyone foreign.
And importantly, this basic rule applies to all foreign detainees, whether in the country illegally or not. Their immigration status is completely irrelevant to this particular right under the VCCR.
Okay. But then there's the mandatory rule.
Then there's the mandatory rule. This is where it gets stricter. Certain consulates must be notified regardless of the wishes of the detainee. This overrides individual privacy preferences in specific cases because of very specific bilateral treaties that the U.S. has signed with certain countries.
How does an officer know which countries?
Officers are specifically directed to consult crucial resources, like the official Consular Notification Access Handbook and reference cards provided by the State Department. These list the definitive countries where notification is mandatory.
Got it. So once a consulate is notified, either because the person asked or because it was mandatory, what kind of access do these consular officials actually get? Do they just get a phone call saying your citizen was arrested, or can they actively intervene?
VCCR Article 36, Part 1, outlines very specific and actually quite broad rights of access for consular officers. Mm-hmm. They shall be free to communicate with nationals of the sending state and to have access to them. That means they can visit in person, call them, write letters.
So direct contact is guaranteed.
Yes. And the holding authorities, like the jail, are obligated to inform the consular post without delay if the national requests it, or if it's one of those mandatory notification countries. The detainee must also be clearly informed of these rights by the detaining authorities.
What can the consul actually do for their citizen?
The functions of a consular official can be quite extensive. They can help arrange legal representation for their national. They can monitor the case progress to ensure fair treatment under local law. They can monitor the conditions of confinement to make sure they're humane. And they can even provide necessities like reading material, food, or medicine within jail rules, of course.
Are there limits?
Yes, there are limitations. Consuls must always follow the detention facility's established regulations regarding security and the time, place, and manner of visits. They can't just show up whenever they want. And crucially, consular officers must refrain from taking action on behalf of a national who is in prison, custody, or detention if he expressly opposes such action. Unless, again, it's a mandatory notification country, in mandatory cases, notification happens regardless of opposition.
It's an intricate dance.
It really is. This intricate dance reflects the broader picture of international diplomatic relations and the mutual protection of citizens abroad.
Okay, so let's get practical. For an officer on the ground dealing with an arrest, what are the concrete step-by-step procedures they need to follow when they realize they've arrested a foreign national? It sounds like there are four key steps outlined.
Yes, the process is streamlined into clear four steps in foreign national arrest to try and ensure compliance. First, ask if they're U.S. citizens. If they say no, immediately determine their country of nationality. This is the initial and crucial identifying step. Can't proceed without knowing the country.
Step two.
Second, check the official list of mandatory notification countries, that State Department list we mentioned. If the individual's country is on this mandatory list, the consulate must be notified without delay. Our sources mention that most bilateral treaties allow a maximum 72 hours for this notification to happen, so prompt action is vital.
Okay, check the list. Notify if mandatory. Step three.
Third, if the individual's country is not a mandatory notification country, then you ask them directly, do you wish for your consulate to be notified? And crucially, you must then make a clear written record of their response, whether they say yes or no. This respects the individual's privacy choice if their country isn't on that mandatory list.
Document their wish. And step four.
Finally, document the notification itself if one was made, either mandatory or requested. This means recording the exact date, time, the method used for notification, like a phone call, email, fax, and the specific person or department notified at the consulate. This ensures a clear paper trail for compliance and accountability.
Let's run through a few consular notification scenarios to really nail this down, because there are some surprising nuances here. It sounds like it can lead to different outcomes based on the country and what the detainee wants.
Definitely. The examples really help clarify it.
Okay, scenario one. John Sato, a citizen of Japan, is arrested for assault. He explicitly states he does not want his consulate contacted. What happens?
Okay, John Sato, citizen of Japan. Japan is not on the list of mandatory notification countries, according to the State Department resources. Since he explicitly states he does not want his consulate notified, his privacy choice prevails here. The officer would simply document his refusal in the arrest record and take no further action regarding notification. His wishes are respected in this case.
Makes sense. Okay, scenario two. Maria Garcia, arrested for prostitution, citizen of Belize, she says she doesn't care if her consulate is contacted. So she's not actively refusing, but she's not actively requesting either. What then?
This is a key difference and highlights that mandatory rule. Belize is a mandatory notification country. Even though Maria says she doesn't care, the officer is still legally obligated under the treaty to notify the Belize consulate without delay. Her personal preference, or lack thereof, does not override the binding treaty obligation.
So notify regardless.
Right. The officer would document her response, doesn't care, and then proceed with the mandatory notification to the Belize consulate.
Okay. Scenario three. Robert Tan, citizen of Singapore, arrested for theft. He also says he doesn't want his consulate notified. Similar situation to John Sato, right? But different country.
Right. Similar wish, but different outcome, because Singapore is also a mandatory notification country. Just like with Maria Garcia from Belize, despite Robert Tan's stated wish not to have his consulate notified, the officer must proceed with notification without delay because of the treaty obligation between the U.S. and Singapore. His wishes are superseded by the mandatory notification rule. It really emphasizes that international commitment.
Got it. Mandatory means mandatory. Final scenario at scenario four. A Mexican citizen is arrested. They do want notification, but they are here in the U.S. illegally. This seems like it could get complicated with immigration status involved.
This is a perfect scenario for that moment you mentioned earlier. Mexico is a VCCR country where the detainee's wishes are generally respected. It's not typically listed as mandatory for all arrests, though specifics can vary. Here, the detainee explicitly wants notification. The crucial point, and this often surprises people, is that even if the individual's in the U.S. illegally, their VCCR rights still apply.
Immigration status doesn't matter for this.
Immigration status does not negate the right to consular notification under the Vienna Convention. Therefore, since the Mexican citizen wants notification, the officer would proceed to notify the Mexican consulate as requested. The key takeaway, the nuance here, is that it's not about being here illegally when it comes to VCCR rights. It's about the specific treaty obligations with their country, mandatory or not, and the individual's expressed wish if it's not mandatory. It's a fundamental international right afforded to foreign nationals regardless of how they entered the country.
That makes perfect sense. Fascinating. Okay, related to all this international protocol, but distinct, is the concept of diplomatic immunity. What does law enforcement need to know about navigating that really complex area?
Diplomatic immunity, yeah, that's governed by U.S. Code Title 22, Section 254, known as the Diplomatic Relations Act.
Yeah.
It is indeed a complex area that officers have to navigate carefully. The Office of Foreign Missions, or OFM, within the U.S. Department of State, is the key agency here. They oversee these immunities and provide guidance and support to law enforcement.
So what should an officer do if someone claims immunity?
If a law enforcement officer encounters someone claiming diplomatic immunity, the OFM provides a clear memorable acronym, the CAN principle, for guidance.
CAN. Okay, what does that stand for?
C is for call the Department of State. There are specific 247 phone numbers provided, 202-647-3417, during business hours and after hours numbers like 571-345-3146 or a toll-free 1-866-217-2089. The first and most critical step is to immediately call and verify the person's immunity status and level. Not all embassy staff have full immunity.
Verify first. Got it.
A is for assist by providing detailed documentation of the incident. Officers should follow their usual law enforcement procedures as much as possible and issue any relevant citations. The source material explicitly states, remember that anyone can get a traffic citation.
So even if you can't arrest, you can still cite them.
Exactly. Even if a physical arrest isn't possible due to verified immunity, thorough documentation, including issuing citations, like for a traffic violation, is still incredibly important for the record.
Okay.
N is for notify OFM. Once the incident is documented, the officer or their agency must send copies of all citations and reports to the Department of State, specifically to their OFM email addresses, ofmimmunity@state.gov or ofmhouston@state.gov for certain regions.
So the takeaway seems to be immunity is respected, but officer and public safety are still paramount, and meticulous documentation is absolutely key for follow-up through diplomatic channels, even if an arrest isn't made on the spot.
Exactly right. The key takeaway is that while diplomatic immunity is respected under international law, it doesn't mean a diplomat can act with complete impunity without any record being made. The thorough documentation by the officer allows the OFM to pursue the matter through appropriate diplomatic channels.
What can OFM do?
Well, this could include requesting the termination of the diplomat's tour in the U.S., meaning they'd be declared persona non grata and sent back to their home country. Or, in rare, very severe cases, the sending country might be asked to waive immunity, which could potentially allow for prosecution within the U.S. legal system. It's a very delicate, intricate dance between domestic law enforcement responsibilities and the complex world of international law and diplomacy.
Definitely complex. Okay, let's move now into the crucial post-arrest responsibilities, particularly regarding judicial processes and the strict time limits that are so vital for ensuring due process and protecting an individual's rights. This moves us beyond the initial intake at the jail and into the legal system's direct engagement with the arrested person.
This is where the Texas Code of Criminal Procedures, CCP, really comes into play, especially Article 15.17, titled Duties of Arresting Officer and Magistrate. This is absolutely central to upholding constitutional rights. The law explicitly mandates that an arrested person must be taken before a magistrate without unnecessary delay, but no later than 48 hours after the person is arrested.
48 hours. That's a hard deadline.
That is a hard deadline. It's designed to prevent arbitrary prolonged detention without judicial oversight. This appearance can be before the magistrate in the county where the arrest happened, or sometimes even a magistrate in another county if it allows for more expeditious warnings. And it can be done in person, or increasingly common these days, via video conference.
What exactly are the magistrate's duties once the arrested person is brought before them? It sounds like a really critical moment for informing the individual of their rights.
It is indeed. The magistrate has several critical, legally defined duties they must perform. They must inform in clear language the person arrested of the accusation against him and of any affidavit filed therewith. Basically tell them what they're charged with.
And their rights, like Miranda.
Yeah.
Yes, and more. They must clearly inform the individual of their fundamental rights. Right to retain counsel, of his right to remain silent, of his right to have an attorney present during any interview with peace officers or attorneys representing the state, of his right to terminate the interview at any time, and of his right to have an examining trial.
The right to a lawyer is key there. How does that work if they can't afford one?
Crucially, the magistrate also informs them of the right to request appointed counsel if the person cannot afford counsel, and explains how to do so. They have to ensure the person has reasonable assistance in completing the necessary forms for requesting appointment of counsel.
So they help with the paperwork.
They ensure help is available, yes. If the magistrate is authorized to appoint counsel, which varies by county court, they might do it right then. Or they must transmit the completed forms to the court or authority responsible for appointing counsel within 24 hours of the request being made.
What else does the magistrate cover?
They must also inform the person that statements made by him may be used against him in court, that classic warning. They have to allow reasonable time and opportunity to consult counsel if requested. They need to determine if the person is already out on bail for another offense. And finally, they must admit the person to bail if the offense they're charged with allows for bail under the law.
And this whole interaction is recorded.
Yes, a meticulous record of this entire communication. The warnings, the requests, everything must be made and preserved. For 91 days if it's a misdemeanor case, or 120 days for a felony case. It serves as a critical safeguard, proof that the rights were given.
So strict time limits there for the initial appearance and rights notification. What about bond release itself, particularly for warrantless arrests? Are there similar hard deadlines for actually releasing someone if probable cause isn't established quickly by a judge?
Yes, very much so. And these are equally strict, designed to prevent indefinite detention without proper judicial oversight. CCP Article 17.033, release on bond of certain persons arrested without a warrant, sets clear, crucial timelines for this.
Okay, what are they? For misdemeanors, first.
For misdemeanors, if a person is arrested without a warrant and subsequently detained in jail, they must be released on bond.
The statute mentions an amount not to exceed $5,000 no later than 24 hours after the arrest, if probable cause hasn't yet been determined by a magistrate during that time.
Released automatically after 24 hours if no PC finding.
Released on bond, yes. And if they are unable to obtain a surety, like a bail bondsman, or make the cash deposit for that bond, they must be released on a personal bond. That's essentially released on their own recognizance, their promise to appear in court.
And for felonies, is the timeline longer, given their more serious charges?
For felonies, the same principle applies, but the timeline is extended slightly. Release on bond up to $10,000 in this case must happen no later than 48 hours after the warrantless arrest if probable cause hasn't been determined by a magistrate. And again, if they can't secure a surety or make the deposit, release is mandated on a personal bond.
Can that deadline be extended?
There is a specific provision. A magistrate can postpone this mandatory release for up to 72 hours total from the arrest time, but only if the state attorney files a formal application requesting the delay. And that application must state a concrete reason why probable cause hasn't been determined within the initial 24 or 48-hour time frame. It can't just be arbitrary delay.
Any exceptions, like medical issues?
Yes, there's an important humanitarian exception noted. If an arrested person requires emergency medical treatment at a hospital or other facility, these time limits in the 24 or 48 hours don't start ticking until they are officially released from that medical facility.
Okay. So these strict timelines are really a critical safeguard within our justice system. They prevent people from being held indefinitely without a judge reviewing the probable cause for their arrest, ensures every gear in the system moves on time, like you said.
Exactly. It's a fundamental due process protection.
These timelines are fascinating, really reveal a lot about the system's checks and balances. What about special circumstances? Like, say, someone is arrested for an offense committed in a different county. Or if the accused has specific needs, like disabilities or language barriers, how does the system handle those?
Those are important considerations, absolutely, for ensuring equitable treatment. Mm-hmm. CCP Article 15.18, Arrest for Out-of-County Offense, specifically addresses arrests where the warrant was issued in a different county than where the person was caught.
So where do they see a magistrate?
In such cases, the person is taken before a magistrate in the county of arrest, or potentially any other county that might offer more expeditious warnings, which could even include the county where the warrant was originally issued.
What can that magistrate do if the offense wasn't even in their county?
The magistrate's role here is actually quite comprehensive. They can take bail if the warrant allows for it and the amount is set, and then transmit that bail paperwork to the proper court in the originating county. For warrants that are just for fines, like old traffic tickets, the magistrate in the arresting county can even go further. Except... please set the fine amount, accept payments, give credit for any time served, determine if the person is indigent, and then potentially discharge the defendant right there.
Wow, they can handle the whole case sometimes.
For those minor, fine-only cases, yes, potentially. They also have the duty to inform the accused about the procedures for requesting appointed counsel, ensure they get help with the forms if needed, and transmit those forms to the issuing county's court within 24 hours if counsel is requested.
And what about Class C misdemeanors specifically? Those are usually the lowest level offenses, right? Is there a different release procedure there, maybe simpler?
Yes. For Class C misdemeanors, the magistrate first identifies the accused with certainty. Then they have the discretion to release the person without requiring a bond. Instead, they can issue a written order for the person to appear for arraignment on a specific date.
So release on a promise to appear, basically?
Essentially, yes. It provides flexibility for minor infractions. However, there's a catch. If the accused fails to appear on that designated date, the judge then issues an arrest warrant. And if they get arrested again on that warrant, the initial bail amount can be doubled as a penalty for not showing up.
Okay. Consequences for missing court.
Right. And for situations where someone appears on a citation, like a ticket, the magistrate performs the arraignment procedure and can then either release the individual on a personal recognizance PR bond or set bail if there's good cause to believe they might not appear otherwise.
That covers the charges and location. But you mentioned accused with special needs earlier. How does the system adapt to make sure their rights are protected and they understand what's happening?
The law makes specific crucial provisions for these individuals. It's about ensuring their rights are equally protected and that they can actually understand the proceedings. If the magistrate receives credible information that an accused person might have a mental illness or an intellectual disability, they are required to conduct proceedings under other specific articles of the CCP, like 16.22 or 17.032. These often lead to mental health assessments or specialized placement to ensure their needs are addressed properly.
What about deafness or language barriers?
If the accused is deaf, the law is very clear. An interpreter who is qualified and sworn under CCP 38.31 must be appointed. Their job is to interpret all the warnings and proceedings into a language the person can understand, which explicitly includes American Sign Language.
Must be appointed. Okay.
Similarly, if the person doesn't speak and understand the English language, they must be informed of their rights and the charges in a manner consistent with CCP 38.30. This usually means providing a qualified language interpreter to ensure comprehension.
So, real efforts to ensure understanding.
The law mandates it. It's fundamental to due process.
And finally, a very specific scenario that often involves interstate cooperation. Arrests by out-of-state officers who are in fresh pursuit across state lines.
Yes, that's covered under CCP 14.051. If an officer from another state makes an arrest in Texas while in fresh pursuit, they bring the individual before a magistrate in the Texas county where the arrest occurred. The magistrate then has a critical job. Determine if the arrest was lawful according to the laws of the state the officer came from.
What if the arrest wasn't lawful back home?
If the magistrate determines the arrest was unlawful under the originating state's law, the person is immediately released. If the arrest was lawful, then the person is legally considered a fugitive from justice under the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act. That act then dictates the next steps for their disposition, which usually involves formal extradition proceedings and coordination between the states involved. It highlights that intricate legal web that extends even beyond state lines.
So many layers to this. It really highlights how much legal detail goes into what might seem like a straightforward arrest process. All of this ultimately leads, for those not immediately released, to either a formal order of commitment to jail or the setting and posting of bail. How do those procedures work? What are the crucial distinctions in setting and taking bail, especially between misdemeanors and felonies?
Right. Once the magistrate has completed their initial duties, the warnings, rights, advisement, etc., if bail isn't granted for some reason, or if it is granted but the person can't make it, a formal commitment order is issued. This is under CCP 16.21.
What exactly is a commitment order?
It's a specific order from the magistrate directing the sheriff to receive and jail a person who hasn't made bail. It's important to understand this is not an arrest warrant. It's typically issued after the initial arraignment and the magistrate's warnings. The commitment order has specific requirements. It must run in the name of the state of Texas, be addressed to the sheriff of the county jail, clearly state the offense the person is accused of, and their name, or a clear description if the name isn't known, indicate which court and when the defendant is supposed to answer the charges, and if bail was granted but not made, it must state the specific amount of bail set.
Okay, it's the official order to hold someone.
Exactly. And if the prisoner is being sent out of the county where the prosecution is happening, maybe due to lack of jail space, the commitment order must explicitly state that there is no safe jail in the proper county.
Okay. Now, what about the actual process of setting and taking bail? There are clear distinctions you mentioned between misdemeanors and felonies, and also whether the court is technically in session or not.
Yes. These are very important practical distinctions for the officers and jailers involved day to day. Let's start with bail and misdemeanors. That's covered by CCP 17.2. The law allows that the sheriff, any peace officer, or a licensed jailer may take a bail bond from a defendant who is already in custody on a misdemeanor charge. This can happen whether the relevant court is in session or on vacation closed.
So they can process the bond fairly easily?
Generally, yes. However, before doing so, they must obtain the defendant's criminal history information. For very minor cases, specifically fine-only misdemeanors or situations involving just a citation, the officer or jailer can make the decision to release on bail without having to consider specific factors related to potential violence.
But what if violence is a factor?
That's a key exception. If the defendant is charged with or has a prior conviction for an offense involving violence, then the officer or jailer cannot set the bail amount themselves. They can only take the bail in an amount that has already been specifically set by the court or a magistrate. This prevents unauthorized personnel from making critical bail decisions in potentially sensitive or dangerous cases.
Okay, that makes sense. Control rests with the judiciary for violence-related charges. Now, for felonies, where the stakes are obviously much higher, how does the bail process differ?
For bail and felonies, there are two main scenarios laid out, basically depending on whether the relevant court is actively open for business. CCP 17.21 covers the situation where the court is in session. If the court where the felony prosecution is pending is actively in session, that court explicitly fixes the amount of bail required and also determines that the accused is eligible for a personal bond.
So the court makes the call. Who handles the paperwork?
Once the court sets the amount, the sheriff or another authorized peace officer, the statute specifically says not city police officers in this context, or a licensed jailer, again, not city personnel, according to the statute, is then authorized to take and approve the bail bond in the exact amount fixed by the court. An interesting point here is that the defendant or their sureties don't even need to appear in court for this specific action of posting the bond once the amount is set. It streamlines the release process.
So, the court sets the amount, and specific authorized personnel outside the courtroom can handle the bond paperwork. What if the court is not in session, say it's after hours, a weekend, a holiday?
That's where CCP 17.22, court not in session, becomes vital. If the court that has jurisdiction over the felony case is not in session in the county where the defendant is currently in custody, then the sheriff, another authorized peace officer, again excluding city police, or a licensed jailer, may take the bail bond.
Can they set the amount then?
If an amount has already been fixed by the court or a magistrate before the court closed, they take that amount. If no amount has been fixed yet, then they may set an amount themselves, but it has to be what they consider reasonable, and it must comply with Article 17.15 of the CCP, which provides general guidelines for setting bail amounts, like considering the nature of the offense, ability to pay, safety of the community, etc.
Same rules apply. Criminal history check. Violence restrictions.
Yes. Similar to misdemeanors, they must obtain criminal history information before acting. And again, very importantly, if it's an offense involving violence, they cannot set the bail amount themselves, even if the court is closed. They can only take the bail in an amount previously set by the court or magistrate.
Okay.
This practical distinction allows for bail to be processed by authorized personnel, even outside of active court hours. It ensures the timely release of individuals who meet the bail requirements set by the court and prevents unnecessary prolonged detention just because the courthouse doors are locked.
Finally, what about the notification duties if bail isn't met? Or if another agency, like the sheriff from the county where the crime occurred, needs to actually come and take custody of the prisoner? There must be a timeline for that too, right? To ensure no one falls through the cracks or is held indefinitely by the wrong agency.
There are critical safeguards here too, yes? Ensuring a swift transfer of responsibility when needed. This is covered in CCP Articles 15.19 through 15.21 under Notice of Arrest and Beauties. If a person does not give bail after being committed, they remain committed to the jail of the county where they were arrested or where the magistrate sits.
Who notifies the originating county?
The magistrate who committed them has a duty under CCP 15.19. They must immediately notify the sheriff of the county where the offense is alleged to have occurred. This notification must be in writing and inform them about the arrest and commitment, and also mention any parole warrants if applicable.
How long can they be held locally?
The arrested person can be confined in the magistrate's county, the arresting county, for up to 72 hours after commitment, before being transferred to the county where the arrest actually occurred, giving the originating county a window to respond.
And then it's the receiving sheriff's duty to come get them promptly.
Exactly. CCP 15.20 states that the sheriff who receives that notice shall forthwith go or send for the arrested person and have the arrested person brought before the proper court or magistrate in their county. Forthwith means without delay, emphasizing the urgency. For parolees specifically, this must happen within 11 days of the commitment.
11 days seems like a key number there. What if they don't come get the person within that time?
That brings us to the critical safeguard against indefinite detention by the wrong jurisdiction. CCP 15.21, release on personal bond if not timely demanded. This is a crucial check on the system. If the proper agency, the sheriff from the county where the offense occurred, doesn't demand and take charge of the arrested person before the 11th day, after the date the person was committed to the jail of the arresting county, then a magistrate in the arresting county shall release the person on a personal bond without requiring sureties or other security.
Released automatically after 11 days.
Released on personal bond, yes. The magistrate then forwards this personal bond paperwork to the sheriff of the offense county or to the issuing court. This ensures that an individual isn't simply forgotten or held indefinitely by one county when another jurisdiction is ultimately responsible for prosecuting their case. It protects their fundamental right to timely due process and prevents jurisdictional limbo.
We've covered a remarkable amount of ground today, seriously. From the tiniest details of a physical search and its profound implications for safety, even mental health,
through the surprising nuances of international treaties like consular notification, and down to the strict legal timelines that govern an individual's journey through the initial stages of the justice system. After all these intricate procedures, all these steps, what are the overarching results? What are the benefits of a properly executed booking process? What does it all mean when these countless, often hidden gears work in harmony?
That's a great way to frame it. The results of the booking process, when done right, really underscore its foundational importance. It reveals why it's far more than just, you know, administrative paperwork. First and foremost, a proper booking process ensures contraband is not introduced into the facility. That is absolutely vital for everyone's safety and security, inside staff and inmates alike.
Prevents immediate danger.
Right. This also means that additional charges may be filed if contraband is found during that process, which directly impacts the legal outcome for the individual right from the start. It works to secure the safety and security of all individuals within the jail, both the staff working there and the people incarcerated, through all reasonable means. It helps foster an environment where basic order can be maintained.
And the records.
The process leads to complete and accurate records. These records are absolutely essential for every subsequent legal proceeding, for basic accountability, and for transparently tracking individuals as they move through the complex justice system. It facilitates the discovery of outstanding warrants, leading to prompt notification of other agencies, ensuring that justice can be served across different jurisdictions if needed.
Property too.
And yes, it ensures personal property is correctly inventoried, recorded, and safeguarded. This protects the individual's belongings and helps build trust, or at least reduce conflict, within the system. Now, it's true that specific booking procedures, the exact forms used, might vary slightly across different jurisdictions, different sheriff's offices, or police departments.
But the core principles hold.
But the core principles and the intended benefits remain consistent and universal. So what does this all mean for you, our well-informed listener? This deep dive into the booking process reveals that what might seem like a mere administrative task, maybe even a dehumanizing one at times, is, in fact, a foundational pillar of justice and public safety.
It's where it all begins.
It's where individual rights first directly meet institutional necessity. It's where due process is formally initiated. And every detail, no matter how small it seems, from checking a shoelace to documenting a tattoo to making a consular notification call, has a significant ripple effect on the integrity of the entire system and ultimately on the lives of those people within it. Maybe think about the silent, meticulous, often stressful work that goes on behind the scenes, behind every headline you might read about the justice system. It's far more complex and hopefully more intentional than often meets the eye.
Wow. That's a powerful and truly insightful thought to end on. From those initial safety concerns of a thorough search, navigating the labyrinth of detailed legal statutes, thinking about the surprising breadth of international considerations like consular notification, and understanding the precise judicial timelines that safeguard individual liberties, it's crystal clear that the booking process is anything but routine.
Far from it.
It is indeed one of those intricate, often hidden gears that keeps the entire watch of our justice system functioning, for better or worse. Our mission here at the Deep Dive is always to provide you with that comprehensive shortcut to understanding these complex topics, turning dense information into, hopefully, engaging insight. So, as you reflect on today's discussion, what stands out to you? We encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep digging deeper into the fascinating, complex world around us. Until next time, stay curious.